these aversions are there to kind of get you to not actually see the truth.
That's a really interesting idea. Terrifying things we tend to avoid. There's an aversion to studying them, and we understand less about the things that scare us. And the same elements of Bitcoin look very beautiful and attractive to people who are struggling under the fiat monetary system, and look evil and horrifying and terrifying to people who are benefiting.
Nature can be crazy, but also beautiful. You are disconnecting yourself and you're allowing somebody to distort that truth. I think the fight to me looks like two ideas in Bitcoin, which are immutability and censorship resistance.
I think a lot of it is masked as censorship resistance. It's not censorship to keep cows and sheep out of a movie theater. You don't say they fit through the door, right? Like, why did you build a door big enough to let a cow through if you didn't want cows in there? Yet we can have this kind of argument because we live in this kind of world, which shows us how important it is to have a system that doesn't give a shit what kind of rationale people can come up with.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. I have Tomer Strohlite with me, and thank you so much for joining me, Tomer.
Yeah, happy to be back.
Thank you. So we were having a little chat before we started the recording, and you have so much knowledge. I've actually learned so much already in the few minutes. I wish I was already recording.
Are you talking about bugs?
Yeah, wow. About bugs.
Insects. And
yes, this time of year is beautiful. You know, the color is changing. It's fall. And then there's a lot of times where, you know, bugs are showing up in our house. And we were just talking about, you know, the life cycle of bugs, which I didn't realize. So thank you, Tomer, for enlightening me on topics like bees and how they hibernate. I had no idea about that. And fruit flies. I didn't know where fruit flies came from. And I guess they live on our fruit and eggs. So thank you. But I had a question. We were talking about spiders and why we have an aversion to spiders or why they scare us. And I don't know. I think, do spiders have many eyes too? I think they have.
Yeah, they have 6 to 10 eyes, maybe even 12, some of them.
So that's kind of funny because I have a fear of my own of, I guess it's called trypophobia. I don't like a lot of circles together in one place. So when I think of a spider, I think of a bunch of eyeballs. And for some reason that scares me. Like, I just don't like circles or a bunch of dots, stuff like that. Plus they have a lot of legs, and I don't know what it is, but
very alien looking.
Yeah.
And creepy, and they have big fangs, and so they're, and then we're also told that some are lethal or that they're poisonous, and if you've had a spider bite, it's no picnic.
For the most part, they don't really bother you. They just kill the other bugs around the house, you know, so it's like not that big a deal, but they do sometimes bite you, and that's not fun.
Yeah, spiders and snakes, these are all, you know, and wasps, they're all creatures that are so alien, like they're earthbound, but they so alien to humans that, and they have terrifying, they have stingers and they have fangs and they're poisonous. They're all poisonous, all three of them. So we tend to have fears of those sorts of things.
And I sometimes wonder, like, I've connected the dots, I guess you would say, as far as thinking about spiders and the multiple legs and the webs they weave and you know, all the eyes, you know, that kind of scare me. And I think that sometimes I've thought about my fear of holes, and sometimes it's almost, I don't know how to describe it, but I think when you start to get close to truth or truth of the universe or truth, it's almost like there's this this answer, and such a big idea that it's these aversions are there to kind of get you to look away and not actually see the truth.
That's a really interesting idea. I don't know. I'm not an expert on this one. On, you know, I know that terrifying things we tend to avoid. There's an aversion to studying them, and we understand less about the things that scare us. And if you're trying to make a sociological observation about that, yeah, like there are things that we're scared of in our society, and we dare not explore them too closely because we fear that they will take their malice out on us. And so they are intended to look scary. You know, I think a lot of guns are meant to look scary, and weapon systems are meant to look scary. to project the idea, like, you should be scared of this, right? Poisonous snakes are very colorful. They're projecting the idea to say, you know, I'm here and I'm not afraid of you, and you should be afraid of me. So it's interesting how nature follows that, and then we mimic that with our designs of human things. But there's also, to your point around that, the truth can be scary, because there's a lot of things in nature that are harmful, and we're scared of that, which could harm us, rightly so. That's what that emotion exists to serve.
Yeah.
And if you get to the truth of some things, the more you realize, you know, and I think this is why it's hard to handle a lot of the truth. One truth is we're all going to die, right? And, you know, it's one thing to be walking around, kind of watching out for something that might kill you right away, but the knowledge that you're going to die anyway someday is a scary knowledge that many people choose to avoid because it's scary. So it's like you avoid the scary thing that exists here in the present, but you also avoid the thing that exists in confronting the thing that exists in the future, even though you know it's coming up to it's coming up to you. And that, and then people get terrified as it approaches rather than have some acceptance of it.
Yeah. And that's what I think, it's crazy how the idea of all roads lead to Bitcoin is where my mind goes with this, because people, when you have this aversion to truth, it's because it's the self-defense sort of self-preservation idea that, you know, like with nature, there's a pattern there, you know, there's a pattern in nature, and nature is mathematical, you know, it's the golden ratio, and it's, you know, the spiral galaxies, and, like, you know, everything, flowers, you know, everything in nature has nature's pattern. So it's all math.
And then, but this is another interesting thing that you're making me want to interject with. The golden ratio is, at least from the perspective of human beings, something natural that we find beautiful, that we find harmonic, that we find elegant. And then we were talking about, well, there's things in nature that we find terrifying, right? Like the, and I don't know if you'd say insects violate the golden ratio, but they're horrifying to look at, and snakes and spiders are horrifying to look at, whereas a spiral galaxy or a nautilus or a rose or a leaf is less frightening to look at. And I don't know, I have no idea of the connection between some the things in nature that draw us in because they're beautiful and that repulse us because they're hideous.
Maybe it's because I wonder if when you see these things like spiral galaxies or patterns in nature, and they are beautiful, and you notice the connections all around you and the pattern of the universe, you know, all around you, and you know that that's truth because it's consistent, and then you see something that's scary and it's also part of nature. Bitcoin is math, and it can be an aversion for people because they think it's scary to know the truth, because once we find out the truth, it's like ego destroying. It crushes you. You kind of realize everything you thought about the world is wrong, and you almost, it's a hard thing to go through and a hard thing to realize. And most people try to just ignore that because it can be painful. So I think sometimes maybe with the, it's almost like trying to keep you either searching for the truth, or you're just afraid of learning the truth because of your own self preservation. Nature is also change. When you actually are afraid of change, it's a trap, and you start to slowly, you know, die or wither away. Like, you need change, you need muscles to grow, you need to move, you know, to stay alive and keep evolving. So,
you know? But what are you getting at here, Stacey? You're asking, what is Bitcoin scary? Is it enticing?
People's aversion to truth, you know, why people don't want to take the time to learn about it.
Well, I mean, let's talk about people's aversion to truth. People aren't averse to all truth. They're averse to uncomfortable truth, inconvenient truth, truth that requires a change in what's been comfortable to them. And so I think this is where Bitcoin, the same elements of Bitcoin look very beautiful and attractive to people who are struggling under the fiat monetary system, and look evil and horrifying and terrifying to people who are benefiting from the fiat monetary system. So Christine Lagarde looks at Bitcoin and sees something completely vicious, and I look at Bitcoin and I see something completely virtuous, right? All truth, all honesty, all math, all science, all verifiability, all integrity, all honesty, all fairness. And to her, those things all represent a threat, you know, in particular to her personal life, but also to her worldview that's been shaped to say, we need to control people. People are dangerous. You know, so it's like she views humanity. I don't know her terribly well, but she has this distorted view that humanity left to its own devices, not controlled by better people who are elites, is chaotic and dangerous and awful. And, you know,
and is the World Economic Forum.
No, she's the head of the Central Bank of Europe.
Okay.
She used to be the head of the IMF, but she was criminally convicted of negligence when a $400 million grant was given without proper due diligence. So she's, you know, she's so incompetent that she's criminally incompetent, but that's the qualification to, can you imagine hiring someone with a criminal record of incompetence, of negligence, to be the head of the bank, the Central Bank of Europe? I mean, it's a humiliation ritual to every European citizen to say, in charge of all your money is someone who has been convicted of criminal negligence and hasn't served any time in jail for that. And now we're putting them in charge of all your money. So there's a lot swirling around in this conversation already, Stacey.
We got
to land some plane to get some coherence here, or maybe we just stay in this kind of...
my mind goes everywhere.
Uncollapsed wave of various...
I think we're going to keep touching back and forth. She has that idea where she is a control factor and a fear factor, you know, for people to, you know, and I think fear is control, you know, in a way too. But, you know, even when we were talking about the spider, I'm afraid of spiders, right? I said that before. But at the same time, I appreciate nature. And I'm almost, even though it was weird, like the other day, I was telling you before that I saw the most gigantic spider in my house. And I didn't want to go close to it. It scared me. But I also was looking at it from kind of afar, and I was actually fascinated by it. And I did want to see a picture of it close up afterwards. So it's not now, like...
Let me ask you another thing about spiders, which is like spiders are terrifying to look at, but their webs are very beautiful to look
yes.
at.
Yes.
They construct beautiful structures, which nothing else constructs, and they make them out of their bodies. And it's like, it's really interesting. And those things are beautiful to us, but they're terrifying to the animals. That, like, why do these webs exist? They exist to entrap and capture, you know, insects. I guess that's the majority of what they capture in there. And then if you get, you know, caught up in a web, then this horrible, terrifying spider monster is going to come inject you with a numbing poison and wrap you up in its silk to come and feast on your blood or your juices later on. It's a pretty horrifying thing. Like a spider is a really horrifying invention, or, you know, creation or development, or whatever word you want to use. Yeah, so I can understand where the fear comes from, for sure. Even there's fear in the beautiful things that it creates.
Yeah, well, the silk is something that is beautiful. It comes from a spider.
From a different animal. It comes from an animal called a silkworm, which is an insect.
So okay, I thought it was, for a second, I was thinking a spider, but I'm like, okay.
It's the silk that it uses, you know, it comes from the larval stage of the silkworm, which uses it to spin its cocoon, its pupa.
That sounds equally nasty, but I feel like
it's like a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. There's no, like, the silk isn't used to capture other animals. The silk is just a cocoon.
Sounds gross when you think where it comes from, but it's such a beautiful product. Like, you know, it comes from something that you might be averse to, but then it's this beautiful outcome.
Yeah. So your question about where do fruit flies come from? Do they sit on our fruit? Am I eating fruit flies when I eat fruit? Where does silk come from? It comes from, you know, this worm that is the larva of an insect. We're really out of touch with where a lot of stuff comes from. You know, beef comes from cows that are slaughtered and bled. We just generally are out of touch with a lot of what we are in touch with. Where do the materials come from? This computer in front of me, this steel, is made out of iron and coal and all of these things, which we as civilized people never come in contact with. We don't come in contact with the raw ingredients often, or the generative ingredients. We don't mind coal, we don't mind iron, we don't smelt steel, we don't slaughter animals, we don't even see the animals alive. For our food, we don't enter cotton fields and pick cotton for the clothes that are made out of cotton. And I couldn't tell you what polyester is made out of, but I'm pretty sure it's made out of oil, gasoline products. So we're out of touch with where everything comes from. And that leads us to having very confused views or an absence of views around a
Yeah.
lot of things.
Yeah, and you have this outsourcing of your needs, and you disconnect yourself from, the root of where this stuff comes from, and you disassociate with it, and you just let other people handle it, So you think, okay, I'm just gonna get it from the store. I'm gonna trust whichever company or whoever it is to take care of my bug problem. And like even when you talk about a hive's nest, like if it's
Okay,
not
so
bothering you.
let's bring this back to Bitcoin at this point, because I think this is a good bridge. We're talking about like packaged products, marketed products, manufactured products that are distant from their natural origins. Whether it's meat that came from a live animal that we never saw alive, we just see packaged steaks and we don't see the blood, we don't see the fur, we don't see the slaughtering, we don't see the raising. And all of that. And the same is true with fruit, the same is true with clothing, the same is true with wood, the same, like we don't chop down the trees. So we have this disconnection from nature, and then we're given a money that is disconnected from nature in the form of fiat money. We don't get to print it, we don't get to produce it. Like you're it's against the law to make it. If you tried to make it, it's an act called counterfeiting, and you go to jail for it. And it's a violation of something. And then you get Bitcoin, which is a natural form of money. You can go into nature and create Bitcoin and, by mining it. And if you understand the math behind it and the nature of it, like it's exposed, right? The whole process is exposed, and it's voluntary and it's participatory. So you can participate in making Bitcoin. You can participate in holding Bitcoin. It's becoming illegal to kind of hold a lot of money, right? Like for you to hold money yourself, if you have $1 million and try to keep it in cash in your house, that makes you suspicious. That makes the authorities suspicious that you're involved in criminal activities or money laundering. And so they want you to hold it at an regulated institution, which reports to them, and all this kind of stuff. So there's a similarity here, which is a back to nature movement. And I think that's why you see this back to understanding fundamentals and root causes as a common thread amongst Bitcoiners. And sometimes Bitcoin is the portal that led them into, well, if the money is fake and now I can see real money, maybe the food is fake and I can see real food, maybe the energy is fake and I can see real energy, and so on and so forth. Maybe the healthcare is fake and I can find real healthcare. So there's this connection to root causes that is part of the Bitcoin journey. Bitcoin may be the entry portal into it, or it may be part of the journey along the way, but that harmony between truth in general and Bitcoin as well is something that is this quest for truth to get beyond the veil of the state, beyond the veil of regulations, beyond the veil of corporations, and to get to the root causes. And some people, and to what we've been talking about, some people are very afraid of that. They don't want to see the animals slaughtered. They don't want to see the trees cut down. They don't want to see the oil wells, putting up the, they just want nice, clean, packaged products, a gas station where, you pump the gas and you don't see it, and you buy wood at the Home Depot or the Home Hardware, whatever, like you, that you just aren't connected to the root cause.
Right.
And you get to also avoid the dangers of the root cause, the ugliness of the root cause, the effort of the root cause, all of which is really hard. And it's been separated from us through industrialization. And then we end up with, we have desk jobs or, office work where we are completely disconnected from nature. And we think that that's a human experience.
Yes, and you're such an expert, first of all, at taking all these ideas that I have, and it's like I'm weaving a web of random ideas, and then
Web of ideas.
Yes. And then you're just, you understand what I'm trying to say and what connections I'm trying to make. And then you just explain it in such a nice way that people can actually get the point of all this, you know? So it's,
Hopefully my integrations are the right ones that are related to what you're talking about. I'm drawing them
exactly.
myself from the smattering of ideas that we're throwing up here and
No, you're
trying to.
just like taking, you're just snatching them all up and just like, you know, just presenting them, you know,
Yeah,
in
no, but I think that this is something that we've gotten to, right? Like we started our conversation before the recording, but me telling you about a giant wasp's nest that was in my backyard, and I decided not to kill them until they all died naturally, and then I cut it down. And we're talking about, like, nature is scary. Nature is filled with danger, and so we understandably try to eliminate those dangers. We're trying to protect our children. We're trying to protect ourselves. We're trying to protect our loved ones, our neighbors. But the consequence of having done that for 100 years using industrialized technologies is we've protected ourselves from the truth, and the scary and a lot of the scary truths and a lot of the hard truths that are like, food doesn't come from the supermarket. It comes from nature. What you see in the supermarket is the product of companies that have taken the things from nature, processed them, packaged them, and made them available to you. But in nature, there's no stores, there's no packaged goods. Like we have to, and all those things come from nature. I'm reminded of a quick story of someone that I read on the internet who had a lemon tree, but she went to the store and bought lemons, and her neighbor finally said to her, "Why don't you just pick the lemons?" She's like, "Are those the same lemons that are in the store? Like, I can just take them from a tree. They don't have to be processed by a company." And it's like, yeah, this is, nature. Nature is what produces everything. We end up
Yeah,
having
even
to
when you
process
think,
it into other things.
yeah, even when you think of medicine and, you know, morphine, you know, they get that from
The
the,
poppy.
is it the poppy seed? We're
Yeah, the
heroin.
overwhelming majority of medicines are still harvested from plants. Some are harvested from animals. Very few are actually synthesized in a lab. And even when they're synthesized in a lab, the raw chemicals that go into that come from somewhere in nature. They don't just appear, like a lab doesn't appear with zinc in it. Zinc comes from nature. Like we have to extract everything from
Yeah.
the world around us.
Yeah, we get it from a source, you know,
Right.
everything comes from a
And
source.
this is another angle to that point. The thought that money doesn't come from nature, but comes from the state by incantation is an invalid idea, right? And this invalid idea is what's led to all the problems with money printing, as we call it, right? Where with state-issued money, it's like the state can't issue food, the state can't issue health care, the state can't issue education. It's like all food comes from nature, and the effort of people to grow food or raise food and harvest it and package it and ship it and distribute it. The same is true. What was the second example that I gave? Healthcare, right? Like the state doesn't give healthcare. That's first of all, knowledge that has to be gained through dangerous experimentation. Like, here, eat this. Does it cure something or does it kill you?
Yeah.
Does it have side effects? Like, that's a really hard thing to learn. And education is, there's all the disciplines where we learn something by, again, experimenting and interacting with nature to find truth, not somebody from above sitting there thinking and saying, "Oh, the truth is that the earth is round and revolves around the sun, and so do the other planets, but the stars are part of the galaxy, and that's why we don't see the same movement in the sky." Like, that didn't come from the state. And in fact, Galileo, who discovered that the earth revolves around the sun, or who concluded that, was imprisoned by the state for it, for life, for saying this truth, because the fiat truth was, no, the earth is the center of the universe.
Yeah.
So like that, it's another good example of the state has no authority over reality, over the truth. And the state is often misaligned with the truth because it's trying to preserve the status quo. So if the status quo isn't exactly aligned with the truth, then the state is usually, in that case, an enemy of the truth.
Yes, exactly. And that's why when you think about aversions to truth and why people maybe are afraid of it, it's because these you know, things in nature are hard, they are scary, they are beautiful, but they are also not easy, you know? So when people, companies, corporations, and governments make things easy, they're disconnecting you from the truth. So that is literally the, you know, the source or the signal to be like, yeah, things can be hard. Things can be turbulent, you know, like nature can be crazy, but also beautiful. But when you try to control that, you are disconnecting yourself and you're allowing somebody to distort that truth. And you just, because it's easy, because it's easier for you to accept and not have to deal with the truth, you know, so you just think, oh, it's easier for me to not put in that proof of work or that hard work and just take the easy way. But then when I think the deception is that it's all based on greed, you know, so everything is for your own good. You know, we're going to do this because it's good for you. It's better for you. It's easier for you. And everything's done for your own good. But then it ends up hurting you.
Yeah, see, if you smother, if you take too much care, it's like the example, if you try to cut a butterfly out of the cocoon, it will die. It needs the strain of trying to push through the cocoon to strengthen its wings. Otherwise, it dies. And we do a lot of that similar thing, to not to the point of death, but to the point of create making ourselves weaker. That's the expression, mm-hmm. Good times make for weak men, right? And hard times make for strong men. So it's like, this is part of the reality of life, whether there's a perfect balance to strike or we just need, there's different people who are going to need to be subjected to hardship and welcome subjection to hardship. And that's what they want from life, right? And then there are people who are doing it because they want the reward of easy ship, the opposite of hardship, of comfort that comes from doing those hard things that that ultimately give them some rewards. We have a very wide spectrum of experiences that the 8 billion people on the world each go through, right? We don't all go through the same thing. And so some of us never experience hardship. Some of us never experience comfort. And many of us experience different aspects of hardship and different aspects of comfort throughout our lives.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. It's, I mean, we all have our different journey and our different path, but it's just hard to wake up to the fact that, you know, you need to be aware of how you're being manipulated. And I think it's just so easy not to even care about that. You know, everything is just,
I think it's different for different people, right? I think some people find it impossible to not care, not easy to not care, but impossible to not care. They're on the opposite side. They're curious. They're inquisitive. They have a drive to know the truth, and every truth that they find opens up 10 doors of other truths that they need to find. And then there's other people who are like, don't bother me with facts and logic. I just want to sit down and watch the game or watch the soap opera or whatever it is. I'm terrified of that natural world. I don't want to go outside. It's filled with spiders and snakes and lizards and all sorts of things. And again, it's a spectrum that you have between where people find their passions. Passions lead them one way or another. And I think that for me, one of these eye-opening things about meeting lots of Bitcoiners after spending 20 years of my life in corporate business affairs is, in corporate business affairs, I don't want to say everybody's exactly the same. That would be a gross exaggeration, but people operate within a very narrow band of differences between each other, right? Like you behave professionally, you have similar educations, you're pursuing similar goals, you're climbing the corporate ladder, you behave by the same rules. And then you start meeting Bitcoiners and they're all like living their own lives. Some are into spirituality, some are into manufacturing, some are into energy. Like they're all quite different. And that seems to me to be a more natural state amongst people, especially if we're going to have a diverse world where we produce all sorts of diverse products based off of diverse expertise. But I'm getting lost in this conversation too, Stacey.
It's okay. I bring it back too, because I think that, you know, Bitcoiners are curious people. And I think curiosity is, you know, I think it brings you back to being like, not innocent, but like when you're like a child, like children are curious and children are excited and children want to learn and discover things. And I think as you get older, that idea of not changing and being afraid of change. Sometimes as you get older, you get so comfortable with doing what you're used to because it's easier, and you lose that curiosity as you get older. So I think a
You
lot
think
of
you
good
have an
things.
end. At some point, you may get to a point where you think, I've been through life, I know what there is to know, or all these new ideas. When we're, like we've seen this with our grandparents, right? Like a I've lived my life. Yes, you now have mobile phones. I don't know what they do. I don't know what they are. I'm not interested in learning what they do. I just want to live my life in peace in the way that I'm comfortable with and understand it. And I can see where that comes from. It's like, why does life have to keep being hard and forcing me to change? Why can't it just be something other than what it turns out to actually be? Especially like we're living in a time of rapid change. If that Chinese expression, may you live in interesting times, but it's apparently a curse. If you live in interesting times, those are hard times to cope with because they aren't straightforward. You can't rely on the knowledge of your ancestors. You have to develop new knowledge. You have to adapt to a different world. So there are people who thrive in that environment, and there are people who struggle in that environment.
That's such a good point, because it's like the people that would thrive in that environment are, even though change is uncomfortable, it could also be exciting, and it could also be something where you are finding answers and you are looking for answers, and you're finding things that you could, that change is a good thing, but then when people see the change and they see the fear and they see the system that doesn't want that change to happen, and then it can scare you because you're afraid to be that curious person and find that find those answers yourself, or find that there is hope. There you don't have to be stuck in this fear loop, that you're kind of put in against your will, sort of. It's like until you escape from that and open your mind up a little bit. And it's just like sometimes I just think, even when I see in my neighborhood when we go to, our kids' sporting events or something, I just find it funny that people, when you look around, you just see people that they love to be like, look how we are such good rule followers. Like that's what makes us, like our kids were playing a game and the sun was in our eyes, and me and my husband were like, well, we're going to go over there because we could see the game better. But all the parents said, well, they told us to sit over here, so we're going to do that because they said it. And I'm like, well, we're going to move over here. And we were happy. We got to see the kid, we got to see the kids play. And it's like, why would you? Because they told you to. And you're like, we're the best listeners because we follow the rules and we're supposed to do what they said. But it's just kind of
There's a lot
funny,
to Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in all of these things. I mean, I think even to ask the question, why are some people afraid of certain things that other people are drawn to? And I think that's a really complicated question that I don't have an answer for. Like, why are there certain things that scare me but don't scare you? It's like, oh, well, because when I was little, I might be afraid of heights and you might not be, right? Something happened that made me more scared of heights than and made you more comfortable with heights, whatever it is. Different people, we all have this makeup, and we assume that other people think or experience things similar to us, and then we get all flustered when we have arguments with people, or they see things differently. We say, oh, they must be stupid or they must be evil, but it's not necessarily one of those things. It's they've had this whole history of life, which has imprinted all sorts of experiences on them, and it's a very complex world with a torrent of information coming at you all the time, and your mind has all these weightings of all these different things that it classifies as things, and then you end up having an emotional reaction to something that's a completely different emotional reaction than I have to the same thing, based off of our past histories and formative things, and coming to consensus, coming to agreement on something tends to be very hard. And I think that's kind of this interesting thing. If we bring consensus into it and agreement into it, like Bitcoin is this thing that every Bitcoiner agrees upon. We can fight about what we think Bitcoin ought to be and what we think we ought to change with the rules or not change with the rules. But at the end of the day, we're all in agreement as to every single bit of data in the blockchain from the genesis of Bitcoin to to essentially the tip of the chain. We're all in perfect agreement on that. And I think that's the unprecedented, that's one of the most important and unprecedented features of Bitcoin as an invention. We've never had something that every, like, even with the Bible, there's different ver, the King James version, the this version, the that. There's all these different versions where, and people will disagree and bicker over little bits of wording here and there.
The with big Bitcoin, picture.
With Bitcoin's blockchain, we're all in a precise agreement. That's what the consensus mechanism ensures, along with the proof of work and all that stuff. So we've got something that goes back in time to Genesis, and it's like the dawn of recorded indisputable history. Right? Like, no one can dispute what's in the blockchain. And I mean, you can dispute it, but everyone will reject your dispute, right? Everyone's in perfect agreement on it. And we've never had something like this before. And that's one of the awe-inspiring features of Bitcoin, that, you know, it does so many things that nothing before it ever has done. And this is one of those things. We can all agree on exactly the content of this, of the truth of this document, the validity of this document that keeps growing and never changing in the past. We keep adding to it. We never change anything in the past of it. And we can verify
it as it is true. It brings you like a sense of peace too, because you don't feel like you have to wonder, or, you know, it's like you can actually stop searching.
You don't start the past.
Yeah.
At the very least, what happened, we can all agree on what happened. There's still a lot of stuff that happens that's not verified by the Bitcoin blockchain. In fact, just about everything except for Bitcoin transactions is in that space of the things we might disagree about. But the fact that there's something that we can all agree about that's true, that goes back in time, and that we can interact with, it's not just, oh, look, there's, you know, Stacy had one Bitcoin on the blockchain a year ago. It's like, well, if she still has it, she can spend it. And if she spent it, she doesn't have it anymore. That's a kind of property right that never really existed before. No one can dispute your property right. Like, you just have it. It's essentially intrinsic. Like, if you have the private key, you have the property. And if you don't have the private key, you don't have the property. And there's nothing to argue with anybody about, like, do I have it? Don't I have it? It's like,
even the confiscatable part of it, it's amazing to think that you can have something that is recorded that nobody can deny, but also the fact that over time, you know, no government can come in and seize it because they say, guess what? You owe us taxes on this thing, like a house, you know, so I don't have the money to pay the taxes. Well, now it's ours, you know, so they can't just come and take this from you. You know, this is yours. And it's just, it's so.
You can hide the fact that you own it from them, or you can hide the information needed to move it from them. So you still have to do some hiding, you know, but they can't break into your house and seize it, or they can't make a record. They can't bang a gavel and say, now this is ours. It's like, okay, you banged the gavel and said it's yours. You wrote a piece of paper and signed it into law and you said it's yours. So move it if it's yours, right? And it's like Thor's hammer. It's like, by the divine right of the gods, you know, only Thor can lift and move his hammer. And by the same divine right of mathematics, only he who possesses the private key to an address can move the coins in that address. No matter how much proof of work they want to do or not, they can't move it without the private key. And so this level of security or ownership, it's a new idea in ownership, right? Like, ownership has historically been possession. Like, I have this thing, you know, but if you kill me and take it away, then you have that thing. That's your, now it's in your possession. Now it's your property. And then we try to bring in the force of the state to say, well, hold on a minute. It was his, you killed him. You're going to jail for killing and for theft. But how do they get it back?
Right.
By seizing it, like, by seizing it with greater force than the initial criminal had it. And this is different. This is with knowledge, with mathematics, and no amount of force is going to undo somebody's ownership of Bitcoin based off of their knowledge of such an astronomically large number that there's no other way to get it other than to have memorized it or written it down somewhere.
Satoshi's coins are proof, you know, for anybody who
nobody's touched them and nobody's been able to, and everyone can see exactly where they are, and they're there with less security than the rest of our coins because he used the public key address type, not the hash of a public key address type. Crazy. Which adds greater security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I love that we have something that we all agree on, which is not even rare in this world. It's like
unprecedented. There's nothing else in the world like Bitcoin.
Right.
When it comes to, we all agree on it. Like everyone, someone in China over here agrees on exactly bit for bit, the entire 800 gigabytes that's growing of the Bitcoin blockchain. There's no alternative version that, you know, some people ascribe to and other people ascribe to. Those are called hard forks and they're different coins. Right.
And that's another thing. I mean, even though we have that base consensus layer that we are so happy to have Bitcoin and we know that it can't be changed, it's kind of such a, I don't know, I don't want to say it's a distraction because it's important, but what's happening with these node wars that's going on, you know, and everything, I kind of want to tie it a little bit back to, and I want to hear your thoughts on this whole thing, because I know you have a really great perspective on what's happening with this consensus. Not consensus layer. What do you call that layer?
Policy.
The policy layer. Yes. It's almost like, to me, when you try to change policy from an aspect that says, this is what's best for the network. It reminds me of a pharmaceutical company or a grocery store saying, well, we're going to package this for you because it's faster and easier and better for you. It's going to be good for you, you know, and it just reminds me of, you know, that lie that this will benefit you, but it actually makes you sick. So it's kind of like not good for you. It's just, it benefits the company or the corporation or the business. And then I think the fight to me looks like when you have two ideas in Bitcoin, which are immutability and censorship resistance. I think that's where a lot of the arguing comes from in Bitcoin, because immutability is like, you know, both sides know Bitcoin's immutable, right? Everybody in Bitcoin knows that. But the not side of it is that, you know, you're not changing the policy layer. It should stay as is. Don't change anything, kind of. And then the core side is the censorship resistance, where they're trying to say that, you know, the not people are trying to censor transactions or whatever they want to put on the blockchain. So that's not Bitcoin. So I feel like you have these two truths about Bitcoin.
Well, you know, let me just slightly correct one thing or offer a slightly different opinion on your assessment of the situation, and then we can get to assessing the details of the situation. When we talk about immutability, there's two, we apply that term to two things. One is the blockchain itself is immutable. There's no dispute on that. Both sides agree on the nature of the blockchain and it should be immutable. The rules of Bitcoin are hard to change. They're not immutable. They're mutable, but very hard to change. And there's two types of rules. There's the consensus rules, which are really hard to change. And then there's the policy rules, which are really anyone can run their own, but most people tend to run the defaults. And this is what the debate is about, because defaults are being changed. And it's not the question of what's being done. The real question is, why is it being done? Right? Because there's suspicion as to why it's being done, given that there's all these answers provided that are sometimes hard to square, you know, and there's also the how is it being done? Like, if it's being done by one group of people without the agreement of the other group of people, there's conflict there. And that's what this is coming down to. And really, the big debate is coming down to the fact that the Bitcoin blockchain is immutable. When certain things get into it, or in general, there's a big debate about should we be preventing those things from getting in there in the first place? Because once they're in there, they're immutable and can never be removed. And so there's, just broadly speaking, the idea, should anything be allowed in there, with the exception of monetary data? And we do have two very different camps here. We've got a camp that says, look, the rules are the rules, and you can kind of work around some of these rules and get stuff in there that isn't really purely monetary data. So you might as well accept the reality of that. And then there's this other side that says, I know, but I want as little of that as possible. And so I want to keep the rules as secure as possible from as much of that as possible of that getting in. And there's kind of two very different schools of thought as to whether you should do that or shouldn't do that. And that's what it comes down to. And there's a school that says, who said Bitcoin is money, right? Like, Bitcoin is now this network, this protocol, this policy of what it is. And people are doing all sorts of things with it. And the fact that you use it as money is good for you. But the fact that I use it to store images and data for an application is completely valid by the rules of Bitcoin. And so we really have a philosophical debate around.
See, that bothers me. That really bothers me when you said that. I just really never thought about it. I mean, I've heard that before, but just it gave me this feeling when you said, who says Bitcoin is money? Because the people that are saying that, they want Bitcoin to be store these things on there, these images, whatever they want for preservation of value in the future, because they think the blocks are valuable and what's stored on it. But then if you're saying who says Bitcoin is money, that means that you want to use some, we have perfect money now, and we have a broken system on the other hand. So now you're trying to say, let's use one of these other cryptocurrencies as the money that the rules can be changed in. So you're just saying, let's use another money that's a fiat then.
Yeah, well, I don't think that that's what they're saying, but they're a you know, they're not talking about other cryptocurrencies. They're saying Bitcoin is not just money. It's a good file storage medium. It's a good JPEG storage medium. It is a set of rules that can be used as money, but can also be used for other stuff. And we kind of like the and those of you who are trying to prevent it from being used as other things are one, fighting an unwinnable war, because someone can always figure out how to stuff something in there that isn't money, and two, you're censoring us. This is a free speech world we live in, and we want to use this thing. We're not violating the rules that have been set up. We've found a way within the rules to store data, and we've found a way to essentially conclude that you can't ever stop us fully from doing this. So let's just accept that this is part of the reality and go with
it. No, I want to know what you think, because
I think it's a preposterous claim. I think coming to Bitcoin, which without any doubt was established as a monetary network and has been embraced as a monetary network, and only operates and only achieves immutability of its blockchain because the value of the immutability of its financial network. So that when somebody comes and says, well, who knows what it is? It's like, well, only an idiot doesn't know what it is, right? Practicing obfuscation and denial or ignorant of what's going on doesn't know what it is, doesn't know that it is intended to be money and is going through a process of being demonstrated as valuable money for the whole world. So I think it's a preposterous claim, and it's a claim that essentially always falls down on some kind of self-contradiction at some point in time, to say, well, if you say we don't know what its purpose is, but we want to make this change that allows for more of this than that, it's like, well, hold on, that implies that you think it has a purpose, right? You're trying to change something to make a particular purpose work better. Fact that inscriptions became a possibility, many of us see as it's an exploit. It wasn't an intended feature. It certainly doesn't support the monetary use case of Bitcoin, but others have said, well, look, it's within it's allowable within the rules that have been modified. So you've got to let it go because you made the rules.
Well, and that's the thing, because the rule was made and because this became a possibility, it just brings you to the idea of unintended consequences.
This is what a bug is in software, right? In software, to declare that something is a bug means that the software was meant to operate in a particular way and is not operating in that way. So you can't say, well, you can't call anything a bug because the software operates the way it does and the software was meant to operate the way it does. No, before the software is written, there is an intention to write software to do something. It's not just random code that randomly does something. There's purposeful intent. There's an attempt to describe requirements and an attempt to describe what should be out of scope and forbidden within the system. And this is, and in Bitcoin, it's clearly forbidden to spend coins that you don't have the private key to. It's clearly forbidden to mint more coins than is permitted by the subsidy algorithm, by the issuance algorithm. It's forbidden to mint coins unless you have a valid proof of work. So there are certain behaviors that are forbidden by the consensus rules of Bitcoin. The fact that someone managed to figure out how to squeeze images into it doesn't mean that that was the purpose of those changes. The purpose of those changes, like Taproot and SegWit, were specifically monetary capabilities, not inscriptions. And so it's perfectly sound, perfectly valid to say inscriptions are an exploit, and which, if it can be patched and fixed, should be patched and fixed. And it's really people who have inscriptions that they think are valuable who hold a different view, right? They have a financial interest in something different. I think a lot of it is masked as censorship resistance, right? But it's not censorship resistant to keep cows and sheep out of a movie theater, right? It's like, you don't say, well, you, I can let, they fit through the door, right? Like, if you, why did you build a door big enough to let a cow through if you didn't want cows in there? It's like, well, we thought people were going to pay admission and sit there and watch movies, not crowd the thing with cows. And so it's as preposterous an argument as someone buying movie tickets for their cows and flooding a movie theater with cows. And yet we can have this kind of argument because we live in this kind of world, which shows us how important it is to have a system that doesn't give a shit what kind of rationale people can come up with. But we, you know, unfortunately for us, we've gone to the point where now the rules allow this sort of thing. And so we can't use the rules to focus it. And
so you're saying we shouldn't close that door and not allow cows in the movie theater anymore.
I'm saying we opened the door.
No, I know. Yeah.
And we have no other enforcement mechanisms other than policy or consensus. Policy is individual setting. And this is what this whole debate is on, right? Like, there are a lot of people saying we should, let's leave, you know, we've already made some mistakes. Let's leave things where they are. There's people who are saying, no, we've made some mistakes and now we have to accept that it's too late to fix them. So we need to open the doors more so that less people bring in less harmful cows, right? Or bring in cows in a less harmful way. And then we've got people saying, no, we got to find a way to close the doors and keep the cows out of the movie.
This is the best description of what's happening that I've ever heard. I mean, I'm so happy because this is.
And we've got the people who like putting cows in the movie theaters saying, haha, I can get the cows in the movie theater. That's, you know, and this is, so maybe cows in a movie theater are a better example than using the word spam.
Yeah.
You know, none of these metaphors are perfect. This is why I do try when I'm educating people to focus them on what is actually going on in Bitcoin, because
if you think about cows, like, let's say these cows had a means of paying the movie theater to watch the movie, then it's like, oh, we're going to let all these cows in because they have.
So let's be clear. Cows can't watch movies. They don't have the conceptual understanding. So it's like if someone is making it hard for people to see movies, to use Bitcoin as money because they're crowding the movie theater, the blockchain with cows, spam, right? Then those of us who are making movies and operating movie theaters start to wonder, like, what business are we actually in? Are we, you know, and the movie industry shuts down, or the movie theater shuts down, or it struggles. And, you know, what the spammer side says is just pay more for people. Like, people clearly will pay more to see movies than spammers will pay to put cows in movie theaters, or it should be the case at least, right? And if the movie theater isn't sold out, the movie theater operator, the miner, can make a few more bucks by letting a few cows into the movie theater. And this
is just going to line it with grass so that they can herd and eat. And so
this is where the metaphor kind of breaks down and becomes a little bit unfair, because you don't have to smell the cow. Like, if you're running a node, you don't have to look at all the stupid JPEGs. You don't have to smell them. But you do have to store them on your node. So this again is where where it all starts to become more nuanced, and this metaphor breaks down. I think there's no doubt
it's still a metaphor, but you're right, because the whole blockchain.
It's good, but it's not, for the sake of fairness and truth, it's not perfect, and I think this is why there's such a big debate on this. And we'll see where it leads. You know, It's very hard to predict. I think that there are people who vastly underestimate the complexity of where this is all going to lead, right? They say, oh, game theory, this can be done, so it will be done, or, you know, that can't be done, so it won't be done. And they've all got all their predictions. And one thing that I've learned in my years of experience is everything's very hard to predict. Right? It's only when you have a situation, game theory is really applicable when you have a situation that no matter what moves a bunch of people make, you're going to get the same outcome. Right? Then you can say, okay, like I've analyzed a whole bunch of the different moves that people can make. They all lead to the same outcome. So no matter, so I know that I can bet on this outcome. Right? But it's like when you don't know what the outcomes are and you don't know what moves people can make, then you've got a real issue on your hands trying to predict it using game theory. So like, Core made this change and they said, well, people will run the nodes gradually and gradually more and more Opportune can be used instead of other ways of cramming data. And they completely did not game out that Notch would gain up to 22% of the network at this time, and it would be an a real battle. And they don't know how to deal with it because they haven't gamed out. Okay, well, what do we need to do right now? Should we repeal the changes that we've made? Should we change some of the personnel that we have? Should we change our view of how we react with our users? This is what's causing such an uproar over such a short period of time because I think generally the expectation would have been, well, we don't like this change. It's controversial, so we don't make controversial changes. But in fact, not only did they make the controversial change, they escalated the degree of the controversial change that they were making, and they went ahead and released the controversial change into the wild. And now we've got, it's only getting angrier and angrier people about the potentiality of cows in the movie theater.
Yeah, that is literally the best. I mean, I want to share that because I think that's I know
You got it in the
it's
recording.
specific. Yes, but that's why I think that the biggest thing is, what are the incentives? Is this being done for greed purposes? And what are the unintended consequences of
That's what we don't
continuing
know,
to
right?
change?
I think this is why it's not so much the what that's being done, it's the how's it being done, and the big question on why is it being done. And the explanations are unsatisfactory to many people. And so when you have unsatisfactory explanations, you have a loss of trust. Either the logic and reasoning is poor, or there's alternate re or there's hidden reasons, and nobody's sure exactly what it is, and it's probably different things for different people. Some people just have like a mischievous intent, right? And it's like, oh, this makes somebody angry. That's sufficient reason for me to do it because I like to be mischievous. I like to make other people angry. Some people have financial and economic interests in the possibilities of what this thing does. Some people want to demonstrate that they have power over others. Some people may have good reasons, but bad skill at explaining what it
One side, it's almost like you have a herd mentality, which is also kind of a cow thing. And then on the other side, you have the curiosity people who are asking questions still, and they're not just following the herd. And that side is which side is stronger in Bitcoin? Is it the side that's continuing to be curious and look for root causes and incentives and truth? Are they still going to look for truth and find out, instead of just blindly following what's packaged for you? Are they going to go back and see, why is this happening? I want to find the source of this. Or, so I think it goes like curiosity is that going to win over just people just doing it because it's easy, or and it's following that, the biggest, I don't know, I don't want to say monopoly, but I guess you know what I'm saying, I think.
I'm personally running out of time, Stacy. So
Okay.
we might have to move to wrap up soon. And I'm
Thank
not
you.
sure if we try to summarize what we have fears.
Well,
Nature is scary, but it must be confronted in order to understand the truth. And I'd wrap it up with this. I think if you want to have a clearer view on the Knots versus Core debate, you have to enter the world of Bitcoin's nature. You can't just ask other people to package it up for you in a nice bow, even if they have a fun metaphor. Like my cow metaphor is a packaged answer, which will lead you to a particular conclusion, but I will acknowledge it's not a perfect metaphor. And so if you want to get to the truth, you have to understand how Bitcoin works. And I think this is part of why you have this developer class saying, you guys don't understand how Bitcoin works. I do. But the truth of the matter is, I, Tomer, I do understand how Bitcoin works. And I don't, and I'm not saying that changing the policy is going to provide impenetrable shield against spam, but I'm certainly saying the how this was done was was terrible. It was dismissive of users. It was extreme. It wasn't reasonable, and it was disrespectful. The why that it was done was never answered well. Like, what benefit do we get from doing this still remains an unanswered question. And so when someone digs their heels and say, we're doing this thing because, and I don't owe you a good explanation, I'll use fancy terminology. That's inadequate itself. And when they tell me that I don't understand how the network works, I do understand how the network works. So it's all unsatisfying. And we need, and as far as I'm concerned, we need to protest what's happening, and we need to fix it. To go back to, like, it's scary if you don't understand how Bitcoin works, and you don't know how to get to an understanding of Bitcoin, how Bitcoin works. It's scary to see these two sides fighting, and you are unable to tell which side is right and which side is telling the truth. And you know, and there's going to be people who make errors on both sides. So they'll gladly point out the errors of the people on the other side, trying to say, because they were wrong about this, they must be wrong about everything, which makes it that much harder for somebody. So study Bitcoin. Like, yeah. Don't be afraid of Bitcoin. Study it. I'm trying to go on a bunch of Twitter spaces and help people understand how Bitcoin works, not to give them the answers to the questions that they have about what the downstream effects of how Bitcoin works are, but understand what hashing algorithms, how secure hashing algorithms are, how they're used in Bitcoin, what nodes are, how they form Bitcoin, what transactions are, what your role is, and what you get to do within Bitcoin. And if you can understand those things, then you can have a view as to what you ought to do. And you may end up having a completely independent new view that may turn out to solve some of these problems that you can then share with other people.
That's incredible. That is such a perfect way to say and tie everything together that we talked about. And yeah, you're not trying to tell the future. You're not trying to say where this is going to go. You're talking about what already happened, the verifiable truth of what's already happened and how Bitcoin works and how we want to stay as Bitcoiners close to nature and, close to the source.
As Bitcoiners who love nature, stay close to the nature of Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a nature, right? It's rooted in math and energy and computer systems. And these are all things that can be understood. They actually exist in a realm that's much easier to understand than nature. Math is a very precise science. Technology, computer coding is a very precise science. The hashing algorithm and the proof of work is very, very, it's all very precise. So it's very comprehensible. It's not trivial. It's not effortless, but it's not as hard as trying to understand the nature of life. You know, that life is way more complicated than right. How Bitcoin operates. But, you know, there are people who tend to oversimplify Bitcoin as well. And so they make mistakes with oversimplification because Bitcoin does exist at this border with these very crazy life forms called human beings that are, there's 8 billion of them, and they're each crazy in their own ways. So once you enter that aspect of Bitcoin's existence, which a lot of people try to avoid, but it's part of the reality, then you're into a much fuzzier place. And I think this is where the miscalculations of the core camp were. They said, well, we make this change, and if we look purely at the code, then this is what we expect to happen. But they completely miscalculated what these crazy human beings are going. Yeah.
Well, I love, and even my mind, I know you have to, you know, get going, and I appreciate your time here in this episode. I appreciate your, you know, summary of everything we've discussed. And even as you were closing that out, I already was imagining our next conversation, because I have another whole tangent I want to go on with something you just said. Okay. So at some point I'll give you time. I know I'm not great.
How human beings' minds work, because you forget your great ideas if you don't write them down.
Yes, that is very true. All right. Thank you so much for your time
for
today. Yes, I can't wait to share this, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks. Bye.
Take care.